The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Well, thank you, Peter. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for coming out so early to begin our day. And actually, back in Hong Kong, we do have breakfast meetings, but our breakfast meetings normally start at 8. You guys rise early in Australia. Many years ago, when I was representing Hong Kong government in Toronto, Canada, establishing the Hong Kong Economic and Trade Office, we also had breakfast meetings like 7:30 or 8 a.m. But Toronto is rather different from Sydney. Here, you are warm and sunny most days. Toronto, most days of the year, snowy, negative 20, negative 30 degrees Celsius. So it was a huge challenge to come out for a breakfast meeting. I'm very pleased to be here. This is my fifth or sixth visit to Australia. And I always love visiting Sydney. And your Darling Harbour, I think, is the bluest harbour on earth. Now, I started life back in 1978, graduating from University of Hong Kong. And I joined Hong Kong government within a year. Hong Kong government sent me and my fellow administrative officers, recruited in 1978, to Oxford. And we all got trained in politics and the law for a year. And I got so interested in the law that I ended up doing a Bachelor of Laws degree, external degree, with University of London. And a few years later, I got the degree and I decided to go to London to acquire my qualification as a barrister. It so happened that the Hong Kong government sent me to our office in London, and I did a part-time course. I got called to the bar in 1986, Gray's Inn. So I thought I would go back to Hong Kong and enter private practice. You see, in the 1980s, people had limited confidence in Hong Kong's future. Sovereignty change due to happen in 1997. And so you witnessed waves of emigration from Hong Kong to Sydney, to Melbourne, other Australian locations. So one thought at the back of my mind was, it's probably safer professionally to become a barrister practicing in Hong Kong rather than continuing to be an official in Hong Kong government. But then on return from London to Hong Kong, I found that there were so many issues to be resolved. Eventually, I decided to stay in government, perhaps at least until 1997. And beyond 1997, there was still so much happening, I ended up staying for 34 years. And I never entered into private practice, unlike the friends gathered here. But I did make use of my constitutional law training because I had to handle things like the handover ceremony for Hong Kong's reversion to Chinese sovereignty and handle the establishment of the Court of Final Appeal. So now, for those of you who have visited Hong Kong or who have friends there in the legal profession, you will probably know that in Hong Kong, we established a Court of Final Appeal in 1997. And this is part and parcel of the arrangements to keep Hong Kong going after reversion to Chinese sovereignty. The basic law of Hong Kong provides that we shall have this Court of Final Appeal. And it's necessary to have this provision because beyond the transition from British rule to Chinese sovereignty, we wanted to preserve the common law system. There was no way that courts in China could rule on common law cases in Hong Kong. So we had this constitutional provision keyed in. And the British and Chinese government started to talk about this some years way back in the 1980s. But it was very difficult to make progress. So by 1990, we made use of a visit by Prime Minister John Major to Beijing to get this problem resolved. And there were two issues to be resolved. Firstly, with a top bench of five judges, say, for the quarterfinal appeal, how many of those should be local judges and how many foreign judge? You see, we have this provision in our constitution that the top bench of our judicial system could have overseas judges from advanced, mature common law jurisdictions. And the idea is, beyond 1997, to enable Hong Kong to stay in touch with mature jurisdictions like Australia, Canada, England, New Zealand. So these overseas judges would guarantee our continued links with the outside world. And then we also wanted to establish the quarterfinal appeal some years before 1997, so there would be a run-in period. People would build up confidence in our quarterfinal appeal as a replacement for appeals to Privy Council in London. So off John Major went to Beijing, and he secured a deal. Four local judges to one overseas judge. Legislation could be enacted immediately and courts to be established few years before 1997. And we thought that was a good deal. But John Major arrived in Hong Kong. Some of our political parties in the Legislative Council revolted against that arrangement. And the pro-government parties were not united. So we didn't have a majority and we put the deal to one side. Now, in diplomacy, if you put a deal to one side, you don't get a second chance until some years later. The some years later happened in 1995, when Chris Patten was the last governor from Britain to Hong Kong. And by that time, I was Deputy Secretary for Constitutional Affairs. So this fell within my portfolio. And I had to join the British ambassador and his colleagues to negotiate with the delegation from Beijing. So we sat down and very quickly we re-agreed on the ratio of 4-1. But then when we started to ask our Chinese counterparts, well, what about the dates for enactment of legislation and establishing the courts, they were poker-faced. They wouldn't say anything. So we got not very far, but then revelation came over dinner. And they said to us, well, actually, we agree. Hong Kong should have a quarterfinal appeal, and it should be established. But because this institution is constitutional and so fundamental to the governance of Hong Kong, it wouldn't be appropriate for it to be established before transition of sovereignty on 1st July 1997. So, aha. That's their view. So our delegation returned to government's house and we reported this to Chris Patten, governor. And Chris Patten was very sharp. Immediately he said, well, in that case, let us annex the legislation now and allow the courts to be established on 1st July 1997. So that became the deal. And the resolution was, yes, court established with 4-1 ratio, legislation enacted by mid-1995, and court would be established on 1st July 1997. We took this deal, and we knew that it wasn't the best possible deal. But you see, we decided to forego one thing, the run-in period. And we decided to do so because we knew what was fundamental was to have a clear legislation, a clear framework set out for establishing the quarterfinal appeal. Then Hong Kong community, international business, our international partners would continue to have confidence in Hong Kong's judicial and legal systems beyond the transition of sovereignty in 1997. And this is what happened. You see, when the Court of Final Appeal and our judiciary were all sworn in on 1st July, early hours of 1st July 1997, they all got sworn in common law regalia, wigs and gowns. And the world around Hong Kong, you know, people internationally were very surprised. This is Chinese sovereignty, but British costume. So the Court of Final Appeal has now been established for 21 years. This is the Court of Final Appeal building. Many years ago, it was the Supreme Court in Hong Kong. And then for about 20 years, maybe, it was a legislative council in Hong Kong. But now it's very apt that the building should house the Court of Final Appeal in Hong Kong. Now, we are very fortunate to have leading judges from common law jurisdictions around the world, including from Australia, two former justices, Sir Anthony Mason and Justice Peter French. Justice French still serves on our overseas judges panel to this day. So we're very fortunate and we're very grateful that we have these connections maintained with the rest of the world. Now, beyond 1995, for about a year or so, I became director of the Hanover Ceremony Office in Hong Kong. And a few years beyond 1997, I got appointed as a minister of the Hong Kong government. I carried the portfolio as Secretary for Constitutional Affairs. So from 2002 onwards, I became responsible for human rights. And our provisions in the Hong Kong Basic Law on human rights were very wide-ranging. As part of our constitution, the International Covenants on Civil and Political Rights, the International Covenants on Economic, Cultural and Social Rights, were all to be continued to apply in Hong Kong beyond 1997. So these international covenants had practical consequences for Hong Kong. From a very young age, when I was doing history, I got interested in documents like the Declaration of Independence. And it taught me from a young age that all men are created equal and have equal rights. But then one day when I was faced with this challenge, for a while I didn't quite know what I should do exactly. You see, there was a legislator in Hong Kong. From time to time, that guy would not follow the rules of the legislature completely. And from time to time, he would be nicked by the police and prosecuted by the Department of Justice. His nickname was called Long Hair. He carried very long hair. And he got into jail several times. So he filed a judicial review against Hong Kong government. We have legislation that disallow prisoners from voting while they are incarcerated. And we have had this provision for several decades. Previously, under British rule, elections to municipal councils, no voting rights for prisoners. And then, while I was in office, no voting rights for prisoners, for members to the Legislative Council, for members to the district councils. So I had to face this judicial review. And after working on this for months, my colleagues, fellow lawyers in the Department of Justice, told me, "Stephen, we think we might lose the case." You see, there were precedents from Europe. The European Court on Human Rights for many years had ruled against jurisdictions like the United Kingdom. But Her Majesty's government in London decided not to enact legislation at least for one decade. But because these precedents existed, my colleagues told me, "Stephen, we might lose the court case, and we better decide what to do." So I had two routes open to me. If we were to lose the court case at in the High Court, do I appeal the Court of Appeal and thereafter the Court of Final Appeal? Or do I accept the ruling, put forward new legislation, and get things going? After pondering for some months, I decided ahead of the High Court judgment to go second route. And I issued drafting instructions for new legislation, had it on file, and immediately after losing the case, I pressed the button. So within 9 months of the ruling of the High Court that Hong Kong should allow voting rights for prisoners, we had the first by-election and prisoners casting their votes from prison. It's actually rather tricky. You see, the casting of votes should remain confidential. But if you put a ballot box in prison canteen, sometimes only one prisoner would come to vote. And you can't quite open the ballot box there because then everybody knows who that vote came from and what choice was made. So to keep the sanctity of the voting process integral, we decided to take these voting boxes from the prisons to a larger polling station, open the ballot boxes together and mix all the votes together and then count. So everybody accepted that, the prisoners, the opposition political parties, and people who lobbied for their rights. And so it worked. Now, I tell you about this story just to illustrate that the constitution in Hong Kong is alive and well, and from time to time it causes problems for us. And the Hong Kong government loses cases at the Court of Final Appeal quite often, and we live with it, we stand by it, and we enact new legislation. And for many years, indeed, we have been privileged to have justices from around the world. For many years, we restricted that to England, New Zealand, and Australia. But of late, we extended the invitation to our friends in Canada. So long may this arrangement continue, and we are really privileged to have support from around the world. And I would just say this by way of conclusion. Having served as a public servant for 3 decades plus, I have many conclusions, one of which is this. The Bible teaches me as a Christian many lessons, and this is one such. In public office, remain humble. Never presume that one has all the answers, and certainly do not presume that your answer, your proposal as a government's representative is superior to those proffered by the opposition. Keep an open mind and allow the legislative and judicial process to take its natural course. So long may this continue, and thank you, Australia, for your support for Hong Kong. Thank you very much.
Thank you, everyone, for your questions. We're just going to get straight underway. Now, Stephen, your delivery style is calm and gentle. Surely the work you have achieved has been fraught with difficulties. What are some, or one, challenge that you have faced?
Let me give you the fundamentals of this challenge. It comes like this. The Hong Kong for 142 years was under British rule. And under British rule, we developed as a free and open international society. But then the prospects of reversion to Chinese sovereignty meant that Hong Kong could only continue to exist as an entity under Chinese sovereignty. But then as a community, we would want to continue to be free, open, international. And there is some tension between those two elements. The real challenge is to be able to persist and, where necessary, to be patient and allow circumstances to open up for us as Hong Kong ministers to secure the best possible workable deals for Hong Kong. And all these years, that's what we have done in negotiating on the future of Hong Kong and in implementing new legislation, new policies. That's the fundamental. And today I have put forth two of these cases. I shall see if there are other cases that I need to put forth with subsequent questions.
Now, we have a range of questions, some sort of more legal, some more to do with your faith.
Okay.
I'll deal with some of the sort of procedural ones first.
Okay.
What do you think will happen to the Court of Final Appeal on 1 July 2047?
Well, I do not have a crystal ball, and anyway, as a Christian, I wouldn't believe in crystal balls. But what I do believe is that self-interest, common interest, make the world go round. You see, back in 1984, when Britain and China signed this agreement on the future of Hong Kong, and back in 1990, when Beijing enacted the Hong Kong Constitution, our basic law, it was because of two reasons. Firstly, more overtly, Hong Kong as an international financial center was useful to Beijing. Beijing used to earn 2/3 of her foreign exchange through Hong Kong. But secondly and more importantly, Hong Kong was a problem left over from history. And I think that's a sort of understatement. But that's how the Chinese leadership saw the issue of Hong Kong. Now that has now been resolved. And therefore our challenge, our objective for the 50 years no change policy under Chinese sovereignty is to make sure that Hong Kong continues to be important, successful, to feed our 7 million people, and to make ourselves useful to the rest of China, the rest of the world, to continue to be the international financial center that we are. Provided we can continue to do that, there is no reason for China, for Beijing, to upset the apple cart and overturn everything they have put in place in Hong Kong, including Court of Final Appeal. That's how I would look at it.
What do you think will occur to the legal systems in the provinces of China in the next decades?
Well, I've always spoken for Hong Kong, but not for the mainland of China. I have no capacity to do so. But what I've observed over the years is this. You see, I went to school at University of Hong Kong back in the 1970s. And while I was going to year two, Deng Xiaoping, paramount Chinese leader, came back to power for the second time. And so he initiated this open-door policy in 1978-1979 called Four Modernizations. And under that broad policy, various systems in Hong Kong were incorporated into the laws and the public life of mainland China. Like what? Like how we sell land leases in Hong Kong. And the Chinese leaders asked professional lawyers, surveyors in Hong Kong to go and advise them. So they began to auction off government's land in mainland China, 50-year leases. And then the stock market in Shanghai was modeled somewhat after Hong Kong's. So where legislation and policies in Hong Kong are applicable and transferable, of their own volition, the Chinese leadership will bring this across the border. And whenever they invite us, we offer what advice we can. But as for laws in mainland China in the provinces, I think you watch two fronts. Firstly, Chinese trade will continue to be international, and more so, even though for now we have Sino-US trade war, tariffs and all that. But that broad direction will continue. Secondly, there is a lot of efforts, lots and lots of efforts in mainland China made against corruption. So at central government level, at provincial level, new policies, new enforcement actions, new legislation will be put in place to make China's governance more clean. Like what? Well, like in Hong Kong, we have legislation since 1975, which provided that public officials, like I was, thou shall not have unexplained wealth. if as a minister of the government I earned $4 million a year, served 10 years as a Hong Kong government's minister, maximum in the bank I should have $40 million. And then I have to raise my family too. But if I end up having still $40 million at the end of 10 years service, that's highly suspicious, say the least. If I end up having $50 million without a clear, reasonable explanation before the judge, I go to jail. So I think we may have stiffer laws in the provinces of China coming through in years to come. But that, I have to confess, is just speculation at this moment.
We've heard that, in mainland China, if a person becomes a Christian, they can no longer be a member of the party. And that means you cannot be employed as a government official or employed by the government. What is your perspective on this? Does that sound correct?
Well, again, I do not know enough about these arrangements in mainland China to comment in detail. But what I do know is that when I decided to leave government in 2011-2012, I decided to complete my second term as a minister of the Hong Kong government, and I had to inform the chief executive, and I had to tell the leaders of the Hong Kong Macau Affairs Office in the State Council in Beijing that Stephen would no longer be around for the next term. So when I communicated that to them, they asked me, well, what are you going to do, Stephen, when you leave government? You're going to go into legal practice? Or you're going to do business? I said, no, I'm going to do theology. I'm going to Oxford for a year. And they were so surprised. And they asked me, why do you want to go do theology? So I told these colleagues from Beijing, well, I want to share the Christian faith with people who need it. And they mused about this for a while and said, well, theology is a deep subject. It's worthy of your pursuits. We hope it goes well for you. So even these members of the Communist Party blessed my decision to go do theology and nowadays to become lay preacher evangelist.
When you swear an oath in the new Hong Kong, is the Bible recognized or used?
Well, when we swear in as a minister of the Hong Kong government under the new constitution, we do so in the Grand Hall of Hong Kong Convention Exhibition Center. So it is very non-religious, okay? And we swear our oath to support the basic law and Hong Kong as a special administrative region under Chinese sovereignty publicly. But when people come to court and they swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, they continue to have a choice. They can swear on the Bible or on their own. So that's common law tradition continues.
There's been talk in Australia about having a Bill of Rights. What would be your opinion on this? Also, from a biblical perspective, is it more a case that we have a Bill of Obligations rather than a Bill of Rights, one could say, thinking of the Ten Commandments, for example?
Well, I've been around for 30 years plus as a representative of the Hong Kong government, and one fundamental rule that I abide by is if you're a guest in a foreign jurisdiction, do not comment on local politics. To start with, it's very impolite. Also, thou must remember you don't know enough about the host country. But this much I can share. You see, back in 1990, the Hong Kong government, under British rule, decided to proffer to put forth a Bill of Rights. And we enacted into Hong Kong law the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights that could easily be translated into legislation. The International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, not so translatable into enforceable legislation. So that's what we did back in 1990. And we made clear in that piece of legislation that the courts of Hong Kong could rule against the government and issue whatever judicial orders deemed necessary. So that has now worked well in Hong Kong for something like close to 3 decades, and is embraced by everybody. And when I was doing my law studies to qualify as a barrister in England, I understood that England, the United Kingdom, they don't have a written constitution. And sometimes that made life more debatable, shall we say. But in Hong Kong, when Hong Kong was under British rule, we had the letters patent, we had the royal instructions, and that's defined the sort of elections we could have, partial elections to our Legislative Council. That was only a partially written constitution. Beyond 1997, we have a fully written up constitution, the Hong Kong Basic Law. It defined our judicial, executive, legislative arms of governance. It defined the human rights applicable in Hong Kong. It defined many policies which the new Hong Kong government would have to follow, like we could continue to be a member of World Trade Organization, International Maritime Organization, and we could enter into bilateral, multilateral agreements with foreign governments, international bodies. So our experience, Peter, is that having a written constitution in Hong Kong is extremely helpful. It clarifies the domain of disputable issues, and we let the Court of Final Appeal make these final decisions. And once again, we have the jurisprudence that you have accumulated over the years, decades, and centuries. Through your Australian judges, you bring that to Hong Kong too. So thank you very much.
Back now to one of the points in your talk. Mm-hmm. What does giving prisoners voting rights say, do you think, about society? What values do you see being promoted by this? Does anyone, by the way, know, do prisoners have the right to vote in Australia?
Very good. Yeah. Well, what I would say is that it took myself some years to come round to the view that we should positively consider granting voting rights to prisoners. Because I grew up very close to the largest prison in Hong Kong. My father was a clerk in the prisons department in Hong Kong, so we got staff quarters next door to Stanley Prison. And some of you may know that Stanley Prison was actually used by the Japanese occupation force during World War II to incarcerate British Commonwealth servicemen, including, I think, Canadians and maybe Australians. So as a boy, age 1 to age 9, I grew up next door to this prison. And every day the prisoners would come out of the prison to sweep the streets, to clear the leaves, and to take away the fallen branches. And some of them, from time to time, would come to my mum and say, "Mrs. Lam, you have some rice to spare? We feel hungry." So she would give whatever spare rice or spare food she had to some of them. And then occasionally she would ask, "Well, can you guys help me clear this junk from my veranda?" And they would do that. And my mother would thereafter barter with them a few cigarettes. And they would clap their hands. They would be so grateful because the cigarettes could end up being used as currency within the prison. So I had grown up with this notion that these people are incarcerated and they don't have a normal life like people like us. So the presumption I grew up with was they had lesser human rights. It's natural, it's just, it's the way it is. But then as the Secretary for Constitutional Affairs and being responsible for international human rights covenants, I had to ponder over this. And it's actually very difficult to pin down a good rationale for disowning them. of voting rights and human rights. And I note that some jurisdictions will have a cut-off point, length of imprisonment being the cut-off point. But in Hong Kong, we decided to make life simple. All prisoners, equal voting rights. But it's a respect for human rights that I had to ponder over and acquire over several years.
Perhaps we might just need to finish with these last two and you could maybe just answer them together.
Okay.
Again, just picking up on the last comment of your talk, why are we called to love mercy as opposed to just being merciful?
Mm-hmm.
And could you comment on how did you come to faith in Jesus?
Thanks very much for that question. As a Christian, we value the opportunity to share our conviction and our faith, and we appreciate 100% that in any gathering there are people of different beliefs, different convictions, and what I share is just my personal perspective. You see, this quote from the Bible to me is very important. As a representative of the government, I am reminded that we should walk justly, love mercy, and be humble. We have to walk justly so that every day, the issues we deal with, we try to act fairly, and we try to do the best possible for the community that we love, the community that we serve. And we have to love mercy because as Christians, minister or otherwise, as a Christian, I believe we are at fault for much of the time. The problem is, you mentioned the Ten Commandments, we understand, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not commit adultery, but from time to time, we do not follow the reminders from our conscience, but we follow the inclinations of our hearts. And we end up doing the wrong thing. But as Christians, I and my fellow members of the church believe that we have received mercy from God, and that Christ, as Savior, as Redeemer, paid the price for us on the cross for the infractions and wrongdoings that we commit in life. And because we are a recipient of mercy, we too should love mercy and be merciful. Humility. Why is it so important? You see, as a Christian, I reckon that the Bible teaches me many things, many important principles in life, but the Bible does not prescribe for me each and every answer that I have to come up with. But the Bible certainly didn't tell me that with a top bench of 5 judges, you should have 4 locals and 1 overseas. And the Bible didn't tell me that prisoners ought to have equal rights. There were some leaders who were imprisoned, like Joseph in Egypt and Daniel for a while in Babylon. But what it tells me is that I should try my utmost to do the right thing. And therefore, in public office, I remind myself, never presume. You have all the answers and certainly not all the right answers. The opposition parties have their wisdom, and we should remain broad-minded and humble.
How did you become a believer?
I became a believer back in 1976. You see, in high school, I was originally doing quite well. And in 1973, I sat for what we called the ordinary level GCE exams. And I got several distinctions, several credits in English, in chemistry, in biology. I got distinctions and I got a credit in physics. So I thought I would become a medical doctor. And I was aiming for that. Then during my sixth form, I became president of the Students' Union, and I became Sportsman of the Year, plus a few other things. So I ended up spending 100% of my time on these extracurriculars rather than my studies. So I did not so well for my advanced level GCE exams. I got 3 credits, I could enter University of Hong Kong. In that era, 1 student out of 7 could get in. So it was very competitive. I got in, I was very depressed. My former schoolmates went to medical school and I had to go to social sciences economics lecture. Very depressed. And it was during that year of depression that I ran into some Christian classmates at University of Hong Kong, and they brought me to Bible study, I and my girlfriend then to church, and after a year we got converted. Why? Because we knew that relying on one's talents and efforts and abilities could only get you so far in life. Ultimate answer in life comes from accepting and believing in Jesus Christ. So that's how I got converted in 1976. And by the way, the girlfriend became my wife in 1979. And off we went. We got married in early September. And within a week, we went to Oxford to do my year in law and politics. We ended up not having a honeymoon. We had a honey year in Oxford. God bless you all. Thank you.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.